Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. A meme I read on someone's Facebook page said, "I don't need an inspirational quote. I need a concert." No kidding. Give me Airborne Toxic Event. Give me Junior Brown. Give me the Starline Rhythm Boys, please. I've been happy to watch some streaming acoustic performances by people like Buffalo Tom, Melissa Ferrick, and This Pine Box, and a full-on concert to only a virtual audience by Biffy Clyro, which was really well choreographed and amazing to hear and see. But there's nothing like being there live at a concert. The energy, the opportunity to see your favorite artists in the flesh, to hear their stories that they tell between the songs. They will happen again. And one person who's been checking to see when Vermont's music festivals will be exciting us in person again is Brent Hollenbeck. He is the entertainment reporter for the Burlington Free Press, and he joins me now to talk about what he's discovered. Brent, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you for having me, Rick. Appreciate
it. It's great to have you. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Brent a question about the music festivals you've been missing, you can give us a call at 244-1777 or 1-877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Brent, did any music festivals actually happen in Vermont last year?
None that I am aware of. The article I wrote recently that I think ran last week focused on Chittenden County and the kind of the seven big ones in Chittenden County, and none of those happened, starting with Leaking Windows in May and then on through Grand Point North normally in mid-September. Those seven were all wiped out last year. And you know, there were, like you talked about in your introduction, there were virtual performances and some things that were sort of put together. So Grace Potter's Grand Point North was canceled, but she did do a few drive-in styled concerts at the fairgrounds. But yeah, basically, as far as festivals go, not the year for festivals, that's for sure.
Yeah, unfortunately. And as you mentioned, Waking Windows in Winooski was the first to go. For those unfamiliar with it, tell people about what Waking Windows is.
I love all concerts, all music festivals, but if I were to pick one that kind of really gets me going, I think it's Waking Windows. Mm-hmm. And it has a lot to do with the timing, I think. It's early May, first or second weekend. And it's like, you know, we've all been holed up in, you know, even when it's not a pandemic, we're kind of holed up in the winter for months and months. And it's like that burst, you know, we just all come out and we see people we haven't seen for a while. We're seeing live music in a variety of indoor and outdoor places. A lot of it is local, which is what's great about it. They bring in national and international headliners, but for the most part, it's local and it's intimate. And you also talked in your introduction about the energy of live music, and I think the fact that it's in Winooski and it sort of revolves around the traffic circle there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which I talk about is like a centrifuge. It like creates this energy within the festival itself, so that you're all kind of walking around the circle, going to this venue, that venue, running into people, and it's a great kind of a great way to kick off the music season.
Yeah, Austin, Texas has South by Southwest, but Vermont and Winooski has Waking Windows. When it was canceled, did you think this was going to be the start of a long line of festival cancellations, or did you think that we'd get it sorted out later in the year?
I think that was the gist, yeah. And Waking Windows very optimistically said, okay, this year's not happening, and they canceled pretty early, like mid-March. It's not going to happen this year, but we've already booked the dates for next year, and you know we're all set to go. And there was, of course, no thought that it wouldn't be happening in 2021. I think I knew the Jazz Festival, the Burlington Discover Jazz Festival in early June, was probably in some trouble. I had tickets to go see the National at Shelburne Museum Concerts on the Green for mid-July, and I felt like that was going to happen. So, and I think if you talk to Alex Crothers at Higher Ground, our big local concert promoter, he was pretty optimistic that, you know, oh yeah, we'll be down for a few weeks, but, you know, we'll get going again. And it became apparent, I think, by the time the Jazz Festival canceled, it was like, okay, yeah, dominoes are starting to fall.
Yeah, how long did Shelburne Concerts on the Green, the Discover Jazz Festival, wait before they canceled that? You know, how close did they get to their actual events?
Yeah, let's see, it's a little hazy because time was an elusive concept in 2021, or 2020, and still is in 2020.
That's right, still not sure what day or month it is.
Exactly, yep. Right. Concerts on the Green, because it's not a series so much as a collection of individual concerts, I think that was kind of, day by day kind of thing. Trying to remember when the National was probably maybe a month out when that one finally fell. I think they postponed it for a while, and then it just became canceled. Jazz Festival, I want to say, was maybe early to mid-May. Again, I'm a little hazy on that. But it might have been earlier than that, because they had talked about, well, we might be able to do something at some point in the year. We'll keep you posted. And then it became pretty clear that wasn't really going to happen either. So they did Burlington Rediscover Jazz Festival online that... kind of presented old concerts, which I had been to so many of those that I wound up not actually tuning in. But and Waking Windows had done something similar, where they had done, I think they called it Waking Windows at Home, and they had musicians playing from home, which of course early in the pandemic especially was about the only music we could find.
Did any of the festivals postpone until like a later date in the year last year, hoping maybe they'll have the opportunity to still make a go of it?
Yeah, I don't remember any doing that, and the Jazz Festival came closest by kind of leaving the door open for, we might be able to do something later this year that isn't quite the full Jazz Festival, but at least is some semblance, but then that didn't happen. I think because... And especially the bigger ones that Higher Ground puts on, where they're renting stages and they're reserving spaces that are off-site. They are booking acts from around the country. That's a big ship to turn around. And the flexibility that calls for, they didn't really have that. So I think once the date starts approaching, your hands are kind of tied. And I think that's something... Alex Crothers from Higher Ground talked about in the article I wrote that, we're just hoping that the pages of the calendar turn and the closer we get to it, the better things start looking. So it's really just a matter of time and patience and hoping things work out the best they can, but yet having to make plans in the meantime, which was kind of what really drove me to do that article. It was like, how do you plan for something that you have no idea if it can actually happen? We're not kind of used to doing that in life, you know?
Right.
And festivals are such a big undertaking, even on the relatively small scale that we do in Vermont.
So many moving parts, right?
Exactly.
So Waking Windows, Shelburne Concerts on the Green, Burlington Discover Jazz Festival, and you've mentioned Grand Point North. The others are Maritime Festival, the Lake Champlain Maritime Festival, the Chamber Music Festival, the Champlain Valley Fair, were the others you looked at. Were there any that you were really hoping to see last year, maybe more than the others for some reason?
Concerts on the Green had a pretty strong lineup last year, so that was, and you know, I think we felt like outdoor music was going to happen at some point in the summer, and so I think that was a big disappointment that all of that was wiped out. I think Waking Windows, obviously, and Waking Windows and Grand Point North, I think it was 10th anniversary for both, so they were planning sort of special things. I think this didn't get into the article, but Waking Windows was bringing back Future Islands, who played in the early days of the Monkey House. Nick Mavadonis, who I talked to, one of the organizers of Waking Windows, talked about how, you know, that band would come and sleep on people's floors while they were in town. You know, they all got friendly and close. And so they were going to bring them back. And, you know, in the ensuing 10 years, Future Islands is touring the world. They kind of became a big deal. So landing them was a real full circle thing for Waking Windows. And so, you know, festivals had special things planned to commemorate big years, and those didn't happen. The Jazz Festival is bringing in Pharoah Sanders, who's, of course, legendary and has played the Jazz Festival before, but he was supposed to play last year or the previous year and had a hip injury and couldn't make it, so they had rescheduled him. And then COVID happened, so he can't make it again. So it's, you know, there were a lot of things that people were excited about, like Champlain Maritime Festival. Norah Jones and Mavis Staples were going to be playing. That was a big deal. And, of course, Twiddle does their two-day festival within the festival called Tumble Down, and that didn't happen either. So, yeah, there were just a lot of things that it looked like such a promising summer season. And just as we got to the cusp of it in mid-March, you know, oh, spring is coming, yes, then it all fell apart.
Yeah. Funny you talk about having bands, you know, sleep on your floor. Years ago at Langdon Street, they'd have on Wednesday night some live music. They had the guy, Mike Clifford from New York, and he had a couple Australian musicians with him. They were supposed to stay over at a motel in Barrie, and it started pouring and flooding. And so Noah got up and made an announcement that it was Take Home the Band night, and I got the two Aussies for the night. So
nice.
A fine memory of the Vermont music scene.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. Brent, as we talk about these festivals, what happened with tickets that were sold for any of these events?
It varies. I know, you know, I'll bring up again the national concert I went to at, or was going to go to at Shelburne Museum, Concerts on the Green. They gave me a refund on that. My wife and I actually on March 12th were driving down. This is not a festival and it's not in Vermont, but we were driving to Saratoga Springs to see Josh Ritter do a show. And as we were driving to it on March 12th, New York State pulled the plug on basically all gatherings. So,
wow.
That was almost our last concert before the pandemic really wiped everything out. And they sent us a refund on that too. But then others, I know Waking Windows, I think when I talked to Nick Mavadonis of Waking Windows back in, I guess it was early January at this point, I think they had 275 ticket sales from the previous year that they had carried over. Some people, I think, requested refunds, but they carried some over. So it's kind of depended on the festival on some level and on customer interest, whether it's like, yeah, carry mine over, or yeah, give me a refund because I'm not sure I can make it next year.
I just snuck in with a concert probably about a week before yours was canceled, and it was back in Allentown, Pennsylvania. I got to see Steve Hackett, formerly of Genesis, and he performing the Selling England by the Pound album. And I got to see him on a Thursday night, and that became the last concert of his tour. So
my last one was Caroline Rose at Higher Ground, March 7th, I want to say it was.
Yep.
And it was sold out. She was starting kind of her big breakthrough tour. I think it was the second night of the tour. And I remember also meeting a person there who was a friend of a friend. And we shook hands, and she used hand sanitizer after. It was kind of the first time I had kind of seen, oh, I guess people are really getting concerned about the virus, because at that point I was not entirely sure it was going to be that big a deal yet. And that wound up being the very last show. Caroline's tour was canceled, and
the year
took a much darker turn.
Yeah. Well, we come around to 2021, and unfortunately, Waking Windows has to make the first decision again. So have they decided on what they're going to do this year in May?
Nothing's been announced yet. Again, when I talked to Nick, it was early January, probably the first or second week in January, and they were still mulling. And I think they didn't feel like they had to make any decision right away, but, you know, it is getting close. It's 3 months away. So they were considering various options. He had discussed, you know, maybe we could do some, you know, socially distanced shows in the rotary of the traffic circle in Winooski. You know, we'll try to figure something out. And I think, you know, we talked about kind of the need to keep vibrant, to sort of keep your, you know, the name and the idea of the festival out there. Mm-hmm. I think he I ended that section of the article with him saying, you know, we want to still be seen as people who bring fun things to Vermont. And we can't forget that. You know, it's like every day is kind of a slog of how do we make it through each day. And the reason we're trying to make it through each day is to have these carrots at the end of the stick that we finally get, you know, yeah, that we can go to concerts and festivals. So I think it's kind of imperative for all of them that they kind of keep their name out there. It's like, we're going to be here when you're ready to come back out. We'll be here.
Has Nick started booking or kind of, I guess, tentatively booking bands for what could be this year's Waking Windows?
Yeah, when I talked to him, he was talking about how difficult it was because obviously bands need to string tours together. Winooski's not really on the way to anywhere, especially with the border closed to Montreal. So, you know, because we benefit greatly from being in like the triangle between New York, Boston, and Montreal.
Right.
We can often get really amazing bands who need to kind of string dates together. And it's like, oh, I'll do Burlington or I'll do Winooski in between all of those. That's not happening right now. So getting bands of some national renown to come is tricky because they're not stringing tours together, because most venues aren't open. Some of the venues that are normally part of that necklace that connects a tour won't survive the pandemic in all likelihood. So that's going to make it even harder. And Nick also talked about even, you know, agents who book bands. Some of them who they've worked with for years are no longer representing certain clients because everything's been, he said, I think he compared it to, it's like a deck of cards and it's been thrown on the ground and we're all just picking up the cards to see who's got what card. So making plans when the things that you normally count on aren't there is, it has to be the peak of frustration of trying to put something like that together.
Of the six other festivals that you spoke with, have any made definitive moves to cancel yet?
No, nothing's been announced. Again, Alex Crothers with Higher Ground said, you know, we just need to keep turning the pages of the calendar and hope that we get there. He's fairly optimistic something can happen with Grand Point North in mid-September, though he's also getting ready for... I think the idea is you sort of schedule big and start peeling back rather than schedule small and all of a sudden things are looking good and you want to throw something together fast. So, you know, he's kind of aiming for a redo of what they had hoped to do last year, but he's also ready if, you know, bands aren't quite touring the country by late, you know, mid-September. Okay, well, you know, we've got a lot of regional talent in New England and the Hudson Valley of New York that we can draw upon and still put together a pretty cool festival. So, so it's certainly the ones that are farther out, especially, they are not going to be canceling quite yet because there's still guarded optimism that something can happen. And I think the late Champlain Chamber Music Festival in mid to late August is also thinking along those same lines. Mm-hmm. They also are not going to be doing outside events in all likelihood. So everyone's got to be vaccinated and healthy by mid-August or that one may not happen. So a lot of variables.
And I would imagine if you're a promoter, you're not signing ironclad contracts with anybody right now.
There must be... Alex Crothers mentioned, we've got contracts for, you know, bands coming for concerts on the green, which is not likely actually to happen in Shelburne this year. It might happen somewhere else if a semblance of that happens. And he said, we've got, contracts signed with a couple of acts, and there's like 45 asterisks on it. So they're, you know, it's like, oh, in case, you know, capacity's knocked down to half, or in case this, or in case that. And I would think, I didn't talk to artists for this story, but Chelsea Lafayette with the Burlington Discover Jazz Festival talked about how hungry artists are to be able to do something. So I would think if it's economically feasible for everyone involved, scaled back concerts at a reduced rate for the performer will happen because they are just going to be so hungry to do something. So I think there's some optimism for that too. If things are safe and we can all gather in some way, artists are going to want to do it, and they might be willing to do it for a little bit less than they normally would.
All right, I'm going to flash back to 2020 again. Were there any bands that you got to see live last year before the shutdown?
Yeah, so Caroline Rose, I mentioned, at Higher Ground.
Right.
And then also at Higher Ground, I think the month before that was Bonnie Light Horseman.
Oh, that was great.
Anais Mitchell and Eric Johnson from Fruit Bats and Josh Kaufman. And Aaron Ray opened for them, and that was a great show.
That really was.
Yeah, so I'd have to think about some more shows I went to. I know I went to some local shows as well that, I think I also went to a sold-out show at BCA Center the night before Caroline Rose. And it was an album release party for a Burlington band. The name will come to me eventually.
All right.
It was Bleach Day, and it was a bunch of local acts, and it was such a good show, and a lot of people excited to see them and the other bands that they were with, and then Caroline Rose the next night, and it's like, yep. Season's going to be great, and then nothing. So.
Oh, boy. How about after? Were there any of these ones that were done at the fairgrounds or on flatbeds that you did get to attend?
Yeah, it was a little tricky. I didn't get to as many as I would have liked. I covered Grace Potter doing the drive-in show at Champlain Valley Exposition in Essex Junction because that was kind of the first one, and I was like, well, what is this like? What is this concept of a concert where you sit in your cars and you honk your horns rather than applaud and flash your high beams? It's like, what is this experience like? So I kind of went to that more as a journalist than as a fan, so I didn't focus too much on enjoying it, but it was just so great to hear. You know, I went up close to the stage and took some photos and, you know, got my ears blown out by the speakers. It was, yes, I've missed this. I've missed having my ears rattled. This is so great. And more as a fan, though, I did take photos of this one, too, but I didn't write about it. I saw Nico Case and Lady Lamb at the drive-in, and I've been into the music of both of them for many years, and that was also mid-October, and that felt like, okay, this is it. You know, it was a little melancholy on that level, but it also felt kind of celebratory because it's like, yeah, you know, here we are on a chilly night in mid-October and we're still hearing really good live music and it just felt like, you know, the arts cannot be defeated. They can take the punches, they'll get knocked down, and then they'll get back up and start throwing a few. And,
you got it. Brent Hollenbach is the entertainment reporter for the Free Press. I want to thank you so much, Brent, for being with us.
Thanks for this, Rick. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Up next, we've got Labor Commissioner Michael Harrington going to be talking about those 1099 forms.
Let's celebrate Valentine's Day at the Warren Store with a very special meal created by our culinary experts. Check out warrenstore.com for details. We have a great assortment of cards and gifts and chocolate-dipped strawberries. Upstairs, we have puzzles, journals, art supplies, and candles to warm and while away the winter days. Dress yourself in cozy tops, snuggly sweaters, and happy colors. You can now order online from the deli at warrenstore.com. Warren Village is a winter wonderland, so come to soothe your soul, fill your tummy, and dress your body. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, open 7:30 to 5.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. By now, you know the story. The Department of Labor mailed out 1099-G forms to individuals who received unemployment benefits last year, and many of those forms had mismatched personal information. The situation is serious enough that the legislature is calling for an investigation, and we'll let them tend to that. I've asked Labor Commissioner Michael Harrington to be on with me this morning to explain to you what happened, what his department is doing to rectify the situation, and what you should do if this affects you. Commissioner Harrington, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me. Wish it was under different circumstances.
I know. Someday it will be, and we'll be able to talk about more than things like this. But this has been, you know, a tough time for your department, you know, throughout this pandemic because of the number of, you know, of claims you've had to handle. So how many 1099s were mailed out so far, and how many do you know or suspect have the mismatched personal information?
So let's talk about in totality, so and work back from there. So in total, the department was planning to mail out or needed to mail out 180,000 1099s. What actually went out the door as of, you know, the end of last week was about 75,000 1099s.
Mm-hmm.
And of those 1099s, about 55,000 had incorrect information. But I want to point out that, like, some of the issue here is people will receive multiple 1099s because of all the new coronavirus relief benefits that came out this year. So they will receive, someone could potentially receive up to four different 1099s from the Department of Labor if they receive benefits in one of the base programs and then the three supplemental programs that were on top of the base program. So, you know, there's a lot of duplication. So we can talk about the number of pieces of paper that are going out.
Yeah.
But when we talk about potential people who are impacted, that population is roughly about 45,000 people. And the reason I say potentially impacted is not every case did, not every case was the information incorrect within that 45,000 population, and not every name showed up with the corresponding social security number. So, you know, it could have had Rick Sangari's name and Michael Harrington's social, in which case they didn't match, but there are cases within that population where it had Rick Sangari's name and Rick Sangari's social, but Michael Harrington received that piece of paper.
Gotcha.
And so those are the ones, you know, it's really important for us to get all of the 1099s that went out from the Department of Labor back. And so what I would tell people first off is if you received a 1099 sometime this week, so sometime between January 30th and February 6th, and it came from the Department of Labor, that those are the ones we want back. You may get 1099s from other state departments. Those are not impacted. So if you got a 1099 from the Department of Labor this week, we want it back. And again, it's they may have received a perfectly fine 1099, but we don't want people to get confused and feel like they should use one and not the other and get those mixed up. So we just want them all back. And then we're going to reissue brand new 1099s for all the programs so people know that if they got a new one, it's good to go.
Okay, so any you received between January 30th, February 6th from the Department of Labor, 1099s, no matter what that information is, those should be returned.
That's correct. And so, and the other piece I would say is all people need to do is put them in a safe place for now. And the department will send you an email or a letter along with a self-addressed stamped envelope to return it to the department. And that's to ensure that we get it back and we can make sure we destroy it or dispose of it properly. You know, we already know that some people have either simply returned it to the department, and that's totally fine, and we're glad to have it back. Some people have already said they've already destroyed it, you know, but just for safety purposes, you know, if we get it back, we can make sure that it was destroyed correctly and properly. And that just every time we're able to do that minimizes the risk to somebody.
Without going into too much technical detail, how did this occur, Commissioner?
So, again, and I'm going to talk about how it occurred. I just don't want people to misconstrue that as excuses or reasons.
Sure.
That, you know, validate it. So, but as you know, we have many different program. So we've got a 50-year-old mainframe, and we've got another program that runs PUA, and we've got other ways that we manage the LWA, Lost Wages Assistance Program, or the Vermont Short-Term Supplemental Benefit Program, or the governor's $1,200 prepay benefit. So the fact of the matter is each of those programs were run out of different systems, just given, you know, how they were set up or how old they were, that type of thing. So there's just a lot of cross-matching of data, moving information from one system to the next to validate it. And then there's obviously, because it's so rudimentary, given what's happened over the last year, there's a lot of hands touching it, right? So our team, and I will give a shout out for our team, we had people here working essentially through most of December and January to validate that when the information we were getting from the system was true, in the sense that, you know, if Rick Sengary received $100 in benefits, his 1099 was going to show a corresponding $100 in benefits. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, once we validated that information, in transit between getting that information correct and sending it to our printer, there was likely some type of manual action performed accidentally that corrupted the file. And I think really what probably likely happened, and we'll wait for the audit and the review to bear out the final results, but it's likely that someone performed a sort on a spreadsheet and the sort wasn't performed correctly, and it jumbled up all the information. However, that then went to it was the last person to touch it, send it to the printer, and the printer printed the bad information.
If someone let's see, I want to move past that now. And once someone has received, get my thoughts here, Commissioner. When should people be receiving the 1099 with their correct information?
So they'll be receiving multiple communications from the department, and as you probably read in the press release yesterday, we have some tactical teams on site here that are working, to work with the various departments and divisions that will need to be coordinated to get this out. But they will receive a letter from us and the opportunity to return that information if their information was part of the batch that was improperly exposed. They will receive communication from us on what to do to protect their identity and what the department is willing to do to help protect their identity. And then there will also be a new 1099 issued. I think we are now working on the timing of all that. Mm-hmm. We have an extension through the IRS, so the new 1099 deadline is not till the end of the month. Certainly we want to get people their new 1099s as quickly as possible, but I think the priority here is making sure that we get the bad 1099s back to minimize the risk, and we ensure that Vermonters are protected with their identity and then get them their 1099. And I shouldn't say that, those are all working simultaneously. So it's not like we're going to do one and then another and then another. All of those efforts are going on simultaneously, but I want people to know what's in the work.
And please tell Vermonters, why they should trust that the next bit that's sent out, when it's sent out, will contain the correct information, and none of their information will be sent to anyone else.
Yeah, and I absolutely, I want to just validate that, everybody has the right to be frustrated and angry here. I will let you know that I was frustrated and angry when I learned of the incident, and that is, absolutely within their right, and they should be frustrated and angry. What I will commit to is the implementation, and I think having the tactical teams on site and working with other departments and divisions who are also sending out mass 1099s, we are going to be implementing multiple quality checks along the way, including did the information come out of the system correctly? Did the information, once it went to the printer, get received by the printer correctly? And then once it's actually printed, we will then be performing a third quality check on the actual physical piece of paper before it gets stuffed in an envelope and put in the mail. So we will have multiple quality checks along the way, along with any other recommendations from these tactical teams and other distribution entities. But in my mind, those are the three most critical validation points that we have to have in place.
From what you told us initially, not everyone who received unemployment benefits last year would have received a 1099 yet from the state. Is that correct?
That's correct. There was, we still have not sent out the regular unemployment insurance 1099s, and that's a large population. It's over 80,000 just by itself, so those have not gone out. And there was actually a portion of the Vermont short-term supplemental benefit program that we were actually able to stop at the post office, and that included a batch of about 19,000. You know, so, you know, as soon as we learned about it, with people receiving the wrong ones, which was first thing Monday morning, we immediately contacted the central office for USPS in Vermont. And they contacted all the additional distribution sites and post offices, and we were able to, you know, stop the 19,000 from going out, and even stop an additional few thousand that never, you know, they may have made it to a satellite post office, but never got delivered to a person's mailbox.
Wow. I'm going to reiterate one more time, make sure I get this right for everybody, Commissioner. If you received a 1099 from the Department of Labor that was mailed between January 30th and February 6th, those will need to be returned. You will be getting a return mailer from the Department of Labor. So put those aside. Those are the ones, whether they have your right information or wrong, those need to be returned, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And before I let you go, Commissioner, anything else you'd like to let people know who were affected by this?
Certainly, you know, please know that this is extremely important for me, that we, again, prioritize the safety of Vermonters and security of their information, as well as issuing new and accurate 1099s. I think the one thing I will leave you and your listeners with is, regardless of whether you receive a 1099 or not, you know, this has been a year and era of very high fraud in general. But certainly between now and when someone receives our mailing about, you know, how to protect themselves, the first thing and the most significant thing they can do, and it is free for everyone, is contact the three major credit bureaus and either put a fraud alert and or a security freeze on your credit report. And I will tell you, Rick, you know, even earlier this last year, I did that to myself because just of how much you know, fraud was going around across the country. So that is the best way for someone to protect themselves. It's free and easy, but we will also be sending you very clear instructions and for those who are impacted, offering protection for those folks as well.
Michael Harrington is Vermont's Labor Commissioner. Commissioner, thank you so much for being on the program this morning.
Thank you, Rick. Happy to come back anytime just to help reinforce the message and get information out for folks.
Perfect. I apologize. We didn't get any calls during Commissioner Harrington. I really thought the information that he needed to impart to everyone was the top priority. So I didn't take calls at that time, and I apologize. But we only had him for a limited amount of time, and I want to make sure that anyone who has been affected by the 1099 error got the correct information right now. We do have Fred calling us. Fred, you're lead off again. How you doing?
Pretty good. How about yourself?
I'm well. Thanks, Fred.
Well, that's good. Hey, if you go to Washington, D.C., although I haven't been to Washington, D.C., but what I've seen on the news, I think there's something like between 5 and 10,000 Army troops in Washington, D.C. Is that true?
It's a great question. I don't know. I know we had a number of National Guard that were sent. I think there are still some National Guard members who remain in Washington, D.C., I'll look into it, Fred. I don't know the answer right now, sure exactly why they're remaining, but some were kept behind.
My follow-up question is, there's an old saying, and it says, political power grows from the barrel of a gun. That's what it looks like is going on in D.C.
Yeah, and let's hope that's not the case. You know, there was that talk, you've seen the story from Axios about President Trump having considered, using military to collect some of the voting, the tabulators. And if there is still a military presence in Washington, D.C., it's probably because of any concerns of another attack on the Capitol. But if not, Fred, then yes, that's a serious concern and not something we'd want to see in our lifetime in the United States of America. We've seen it in third world countries, banana republics, whatever you want to say. And it is not the way United States acts or conducts business politically, militarily. Let's hope that is not the case. But it is definitely worth looking into to see what troops are still in Washington, D.C. Now, they were called in during the right before the inauguration so that we had no further problems like we saw on that fateful day, January 6th. But, let's hope that they're just there right now for security until they think everything has, calmed down. I'm not privy to what the FBI would know or what anyone else would know about why troops would be kept in Washington at this time. Maybe someone knows, but I think there are still some National Guard there. All right, our numbers are 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Open phones with your ideas. And let's see, this is Latin who's joining us now, so go right ahead, Latin. Who do we have? Someone in Stowe.
Yeah, Leighton DeToro.
Leighton, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. I heard your shot about calling in if you had an interesting book.
Yes.
And I have two that I'm reading simultaneously by the same author.
Mm.
Her name is Robin Kimmerer, and she is a Native American who learned all about nature, or much about nature, before she went to the Anglo school. She was raised on a reservation. And she's written two books. One is called Gathering Moss, and the other is called Braiding Sweetbread, or Sweetgrass, rather. I heard an interview with her, and I was so taken with it that I bought both books. And she is amazing. They are a series of short essays, and she weaves culture, science, biology, family, everything into these little short stories that segue perfectly into a discussion about, in the one book, moss.
Oh, wow. I love it.
Yeah, they are. And you can read them. They're anywhere from 3 to 8 pages. And she's gotten awards for Gathering Moss. And as an example, in one, she was in the rainforest and described the striations of growth and animal life in the trees above ground. And she uses the same optics that they do microsurgery with to investigate the moss.
Mm.
And she found nearly identical striations in the moss as in the trees above, and nearly the same amount of species in the moss as in the trees above. So I highly recommend both books.
All right, and it's Robin Kimmerer, and her books are Gathering Moss and Braiding Sweetgrass. They're short essays, a collection of short essays in each book. So, Leighton, I want to thank you so much for those recommendations.
Well, you're welcome.
All right, great talking to you. We're going to have to shut down the phones. I apologize for the few others that called. We only had a few minutes, but I do appreciate your calls. We'll do it again. We'll open up the phones as we have time, sometime maybe next week. CBS News is next, and then we're going to spend the next hour discussing one of my favorite topics, and that's architecture, especially Vermont architecture. We've got state architectural historian Devin Coleman, who's going to be joining me. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let's celebrate Valentine's Day at the Warren Store with a very special meal created by our culinary experts. Check out warrenstore.com for details. We have a great assortment of cards and gifts and chocolate-dipped strawberries. Upstairs, we have puzzles, journals, art supplies, and candles to warm and while away the winter days. Dress yourself in cozy tops, snuggly sweaters, and happy colors. You can now order online from the deli at warrenstore.com. Warren Village is a winter wonderland, so come to soothe your soul, fill your tummy, and dress your body. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, open 7:30 to 5.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Here's where you get to see my George Costanza side, the one who thinks he's architect Art Vandelay. I'm not sure what it is, but I am moved by architecture. And if I'm near Bard College or MIT, I drive the car to the campus to see the Frank Gehry Design Building. In Glasgow, I will traipse around town to see anything by Charles Rennie Mackintosh, maybe an Alexander Greig Thompson or two as well. In Chicago or Phoenix, I want to soak up buildings designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. For the next hour, we're going to explore some of the interesting architecture that's right here in Vermont, buildings you can gaze at without having to quarantine. Here to take us on this journey of Vermont's mid-century modern designers in the state is state architectural historian Devin Coleman. Devin, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Listeners, if you've got a question for Devin or you want to share some architectural history of your own, you can give us a call at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Devin, before we get into these styles, I want to know, what does the state historical, I'm sorry, the state architectural historian do?
Well, it's a role that I've had at the Vermont Division for Historic Preservation for several years now. And, you know, at the root level, I oversee the state's National Register of Historic Places program. So if a property owner wants to list a property in the National Register, I help facilitate that process and do the same at the state level. We have a State Register of Historic Places, and then overseeing various grant programs and things like that. But on a larger, more in terms of outreach and education, I really try to get people excited about architecture and the built environment, and helping people start seeing where, what makes where they live special. And as you said in your intro, we travel to Chicago and Los Angeles and New York and we marvel at the architecture, but there is great architecture in Vermont. Mm-hmm. And especially in the time of COVID, just go for a walk.
and
put your cell phone away, leave it in your car, go for a walk, and look at your surroundings and start seeing the buildings in your own community.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned the National Register of Historic Places. How many places in Vermont do we have on that list?
There are many hundreds of buildings on the National Register. And that can be a single house, or it can be, for example, the Montpelier Historic District, which is, I believe, more than 600 buildings. It's a wide, a very broad scale, and all types of buildings. Sometimes when people think of, or they hear National Register, they think, wow, this a building must have to be really, nationally significant to be listed in the National Register. That's not the case. Actually, the vast majority of our listings in the National Register are locally significant buildings. That can be a town hall, a church, a school, buildings that are significant to the local community.
and embody either an architecture or a history that's important to that region.
How far can we back? Can we go back and trace structures in the state?
I have a file folder on my desk at the office labeled oldest buildings. And it's really hard to say because there are some buildings that date from the late 18th century, so late 1700s.
Mm-hmm.
But then you get into, well, has it been remodeled? Has it been updated? What really constitutes the oldest? It's very hard to pin, mm-hmm. The first to the oldest on any one building, but generally, our Vermont architectural history goes back to the 1770s, 1780s, around the time of the Revolution, and shortly thereafter when settlers were returning to Vermont and starting to stake out their claims with land grants from Benning Wentworth in New Hampshire. And so that's kind of the starting point of where we look at historic buildings.
Did the Abenaki have any type of permanent structures?
They had, yes, in fact, we've had some really interesting archaeological discoveries up in Swanton in the last couple of years of longhouses and evidence of their the Abenaki settlements. They were less permanent in that they would tend to be a little more transitional in their settlement patterns, and their structures were built of all natural materials that simply wouldn't hold up long term.
Mm-hmm.
But there is archaeological evidence in the form of fire pits and post holes where they would sink the posts to support their structures.
Mm.
So yes, there is a long archaeological history of the Abenaki settlements, definitely.
That's exciting. Now, we could go in a lot of different directions. We're going to try to stay focused, and we are going to focus our discussion today on the mid-century movement and where we see it, mm-hmm. in Vermont. So first of all, Devin, describe that style of architecture.
So, mid-century modern is kind of the buzzword.
Mm-hmm.
It has good alliteration, easy to remember. It's kind of a catch-all for a broad range of architectural styles. But I want to emphasize that modernism as a movement it's not something limited just to architecture. So in the early 20th century, late 19th, early 20th century, you have this turn towards modernism in architecture as well as music, in literature, in politics, in educational philosophy. It's a wholesale rethinking of how individuals living in the 20th century, the modern world, the post-industrial revolution world, should be living, and a questioning of why, if I have an automobile and I work in a modern office building and, I have a telephone and a radio and a TV now, why should my house look like something from 1850?
Mm-hmm.
It was that rethinking of, I want to live in the modern world with all this modern technology that we have. So the mid-century modern is sort of an umbrella term for that overall movement of an approach to modern life and specifically architecture and design.
Was it very prevalent in Vermont, or is it?
It's something that once you start looking for it, you start to see it, but it's hidden. And that's really been the fun part of my research, going back to graduate school at UVM in the graduate program in historic preservation. I did my thesis on mid-century modern residential architecture in Chittenden County. And, that's really honing down on a very specific category of architecture in one county.
Right.
And that's because at the start, I thought, I'll write about modernism in Vermont. And I quickly realized, whoa, that's way too large a topic. Mm. So I really had to hone it down. And it's funny, people forget that the 20th century did happen in Vermont, despite all of the state's marketing efforts towards promoting that rural ideal, sure, of the red barn in the field with the church and the white steeple. And that's wonderful. I mean, I love that about Vermont, but there's more. And the mid 20th century did see incredible growth in Vermont's population. And you have corporations like IBM moving in Essex and bringing in a large workforce, and those people needed new houses. And the universities, UVM, Bennington College, very impressive building campaigns, and they wanted modern buildings. They wanted to be seen as forward-thinking and progressive, and they really embraced modernism.
What spurred your recent interest in the mid-century modern movement here in Vermont?
Well, it's one of those things that it's ongoing. There's always more to find, more to learn, and it's certainly not it's not a static field of research, which is funny because you think historic preservation, you're only interested in the old stuff. But I'm always curious about looking at patterns of change and evolution in our built environment. And so in the mid-20th century, we have suburban development and related infrastructure of shopping malls and modernist churches. And then, okay, that's the 1950s. What happened in the 60s and 70s? And, believe it or not, we're now looking at buildings from the 1970s as potentially historic structures. Mm. So it's a sliding scale. It's a continuum. And it's that I always like to kind of stay on the leading edge of that and understand, like, okay, what's coming up next? What will we have to grapple with in the next few years in terms of historic buildings and historic significance?
And we had two fairly prominent modernist architects here in Vermont. Who were they, and how similar were they in their architectural style?
Right. There's recently been some work done with the archives of Marcel Boden and Donald McKnight. And there are two of several modernist architects who worked in the state in the 1950s, 60s, 70s. And what's exciting about their work is that recently their collections, their materials from their practices have been transferred to local repositories, Vermont Historical Society and the University of Vermont Special Collections. And that's really exciting, for me as a historian, as an architectural researcher, knowing that those materials are available for research. But also, it's important to save these archives because they document Vermont's history and our built environment. And Marcel and Don were two prominent, Vermont-based. They both spent their long careers working in Vermont. Mm. And it shows, again, that this wasn't something, this wasn't an architectural movement that only happened in the big cities, in New York and Boston and Chicago. It happened here in Vermont also.
And let's take a call from David, who's joining us from Burlington. Good morning, David.
Good morning. Forgive me for a brief digression from mid-century modernism.
That's all right.
There are two buildings at the hospital on the hill. One of them you're looking straight at as you leave the front door of the hospital in your car. It's a rather large, beautiful stone building. The other is visible from the corner of Pearl Street and what is it, East Avenue there, where the Indian restaurant is, if you're looking up at the hospital. Can you tell me anything about those two buildings?
All right, David, let's see what Devin knows about those.
Sure. I believe you're referring to Converse Hall, which is a dormitory for UVM, and probably the other one would be the original Mary Fletcher Hospital building, right, up on the hilltop there. And those are you'll be glad to know that Converse Hall, we are actually right now in the process of getting that listed in the National Register of Historic Places. And it's a really great example and rare example of a kind of Flemish revival architecture. It's not a common form architectural style that we see in Vermont and dates to the late 19th century. And the Fletcher Hospital on the Hill, that was restored maybe 10 years ago or so. It's part of the overall hospital expansion. And it's really a great example of adaptive reuse, where I believe it's now offices for hospital administration, but two great, very prominent historic buildings from the late 19th century in Burlington.
Well, David puts us right in that neighborhood, and I think if we cross Pearl Street, and it's the old Trinity College campus there, isn't there a building or two that one of our architects, either McKnight or Bowden, designed?
Yes, there are two buildings there that Marcel Bowden worked on early in his career, and they were built as dormitories, Mercy Hall and Macaulay Hall, for the former Trinity College, when that was at their campus. It's now part of UVM. And those buildings are really two of the purest examples of what we call the international style, in which they are basically composed of box-like forms, flat roofs, and built of a steel frame with slate wall panels and glass windows. And that's pretty much it. So a very pure, limited palette of materials and forms.
Neat. Now, when I think of these two gentlemen, McKnight and Bowden, I'm kind of reminded of a story. And there's a small town out in Oregon where two Nobel Prize winners come from in various fields of science. One was Linus Pauling. It escapes me who the other was. But McKnight and Bowden, who we're focusing a lot on today, both went to Spalding High School and had a little bit of an overlap there.
Yes, yeah, that's another really nice connection and overlap in their stories, is that they both grew up in Barrie, both associated with the stone, the granite industry in Barrie. And if you think back to the city of Barrie in the early 20th century, the range of artistic talent there, it's just mind-boggling, both in terms of designers who were designing monuments and building components, to the sculptors and the carvers, to the quarry workers. The knowledge and skill in Barrie, Vermont at that time is really astounding. And both Don McKnight and Marcel did some time doing drafting in the for the granite companies, and then branched out into architecture with Don McKnight, amazingly, really training himself. He did not go to a formal architecture school, but he learned enough to pass the exam to be a certified architect in Vermont.
So let's stay with McKnight. He goes from Spalding High and learning it there, teaching himself. Was there anything distinctive that we might pick up as a McKnight characteristic in his designs?
I would say, and I have not had the chance to go through the archives completely. I'm itching to do that when it's safe to do so. But from what I have seen is a general approach to design that's thoughtful in the needs of the client. A lot of his drawings, they're not just, you know, technical schematics. He'll include a three-dimensional view of, you know, the corner of the bedroom, showing how the bed will be placed and the nightstands and a little figure for scale, and the, you know, the corner on the bedspread is turned down. And it's he's really creating, you know, presenting this vision of this is what your living space will look like. And I think that's those details and drawings, I think, translate into the you know, he was really invested in the designs. And, you know, I've seen a few of the built houses, and they're very nicely of their time.
Mm-hmm.
They're not radical showstoppers. They're not crazy and, you know, bizarre architectural constructions. They're just, you know, good, solid design.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's definitely a place for that in our communities.
Now, one of
his own house.
What's that?
His own house.
Oh, yes.
Which is in Barrie. Now that was, he had fun doing that. It's really, it was on the market recently and I got to tour it. And that's where he kind of flexes his muscles a little bit, I feel like, as a designer and really had fun designing a modernist house.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit more about that, Devin.
Well, it's beautifully sited for one thing. It's placed on a wooded lot at the end of a street with a stream running through it. And the entrance to the house is actually a concrete bridge over the stream. And he built in steps down to the water and a little waterfall. And then the house itself is clearly designed for his own use. One house for living that has bedrooms, kitchen, dining room, living room. And then across another bridge connecting the two stories of the house to an office space that has his drafting tables and files and a meeting room to meet with clients. So a very pure distillation of forms and uses within that that little house complex that he built and obviously had fun doing.
Another of his designs was the Capitol Stationers building in Montpelier. It's now home to a drugstore, I believe. But until mm-hmm. I saw the rendering by McKnight, I really didn't pay the building much attention. But now I can see those mid-century elements, and I can't wait to get back to Montpelier now and see the building again, right?
Right. And that's I think, one of the real values of these architectural collections is that they let you kind of hone in on a specific building and see it as it was originally designed and what the original intent of the architect was. And then when you see it in person, you almost see it with fresh eyes and you realize, oh, okay. So that, you know, maybe a bank of windows on the second floor is covered now,
mm-hmm.
but then you see the original drawing and you realize, okay, there were windows there. And you can kind of read the building much better, and it makes you focus on it.
Any other McKnight designs that are noteworthy worth discussing?
One design that was really fun to see was his drawing for the BOR in mm-hmm. Barrie, which is the Barrie Outdoor Recreation Center, the skating rink up on the hill.
Yeah.
Which, to look at it today, it's a pretty utilitarian building. But McKnight's vision for it in these original drawings, I would have loved to have seen that building. I think probably a lot of the design was value engineered out of the construction process. But it's really a neat design and an innovative design. And it's important to note that a lot of, when we talk about modernist architecture, it's not just the look of the building. It's not just the style applied. It's actual, it includes the structure also, you know, how a building is built. And the BOR is a great example of innovative building technology where it's built of massive laminated timber arches. A series of them that create this enormous volume of space that's unencumbered by any posts, so mm-hmm. you can put a hockey rink inside it.
Right.
So it's important to think, also think about modern technology, modern materials, as well as modern design that goes into all these buildings.
And when was the BOR built?
I believe that was in the early 70s.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It's the Architectural History Hour with Devin Coleman right now. We're going to take a break for the CBS News update. And when we come back, we're going to talk about Don Bowden and also Prickly Mountain in the Mad River Valley. To join the discussion, you can call us 244-1777 or toll free 877-291-8255. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let's celebrate Valentine's Day at the Warren Store with a very special meal created by our culinary experts. Check out warrenstore.com for details. We have a great assortment of cards and gifts and chocolate-dipped strawberries. Upstairs, we have puzzles, journals, art supplies, and candles to warm and while away the winter days. Dress yourself in cozy tops, snuggly sweaters, and happy colors. You can now order online from the deli at warrenstore.com. Warren Village is a winter wonderland, so come to soothe your soul, fill your tummy, and dress your body. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, open 7:30 to 5.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. During my trips around the state on my 251 Club quest, one thing I loved was finding a new and interesting building. It might be the Round Schoolhouse in Brookline, or the Yosemite Engine Company in Chester, or the Latches Theater in Brattleboro. Oh, heck, I still gawk every time I see, up on the hill, the St. Mary of the Sea Church in Newport. This morning, state architectural historian Devin Coleman is discussing some of the styles that can be found here in Vermont. We've been focused on the mid-century modern buildings. We'll stay with that for a little bit longer. And then we're going to talk about David Sellers and the Prickly Mountain designs in a little bit. Listeners, if you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Before the break, I called him Don Bowden, and I apologize, but we're gonna switch now to that second modernist architect here in Vermont that we're talking about, Marcel Bowden. And Devin, let's pick him up after he left Spalding. You know, where did his travels and architectural travels take him?
Right. So Marcel Bowden is another great example of a homegrown Vermont modernist architect.
Mm-hmm.
And, leaving Barry, he goes to work on designing monuments in New York City and meets the internationally famous architect, Le Corbusier, international modernist style architect, and who was working on the United Nations building in New York City at the time. And he also crosses paths with other leading architects of that time in the 1950s, I believe Marcel Breuer, Edward Larrabee Barnes, and that really gets him inspired to pursue architecture, move beyond the monument design into architecture, and studies architecture, and then comes back to Vermont and spends the next 50-plus years designing buildings largely throughout Vermont, and actually just retired within the last year or so.
Oh, my.
So very, very long, productive, fruitful career for Marcel.
Oh, that's fantastic. Now, was he influenced by the Bauhaus movement of Germany?
Right. I mean, it's... Who wasn't?
I'm wearing a watch inspired by the Bauhaus movement right now. So
right.
So it's got elements of that design.
That's a great example of the Bauhaus, in terms of background, was a school in Germany that was established in 1919 and ran through the early 1930s until it was shut down by the Nazi government. But the Bauhaus is really a keystone for the whole modernist movement, not just in architecture, but in design as a whole. They really espoused this notion of creating a comprehensive artwork for life, so that integrating the arts and design and architecture and the craftspeople making the objects into a unified whole, so that you have, you know, the Bauhaus designing things like, dishware and rugs and watches and household goods in addition to architecture. In fact, the Bauhaus didn't even have a school of architecture until about 10 years after it was founded. So it was really this universal approach to design. And then that, in the years leading up to World War II, many of the leading Bauhaus instructors, including Ludwig Mies van der Rohe, Walter Gropius, Marcel Breuer, Laszlo Moholy-Nagy, they can see the writing on the wall, and they get out of Germany and they come to the United States. And they settle in the architecture programs at Harvard, at Illinois Institute of Technology. Moholy Nagy actually starts a new Bauhaus in Chicago. And there's really, at this point, early 1940s, a wholesale turnover of architectural instruction in the United States from a more traditional Beaux-Arts-based approach to modernism. And that's really a pivotal turning point, is when those Bauhaus instructors leave Germany and come to the United States, and then their philosophies are passed on to generations of architectural students in America.
Marcel Boden, influenced by this, you said he just retired. How many designs did he have in his career?
Oh, hundreds. He recently sent me a list of his projects.
Mm-hmm.
It's I don't know, 50 pages long, at least. So,
oh, my.
And, you know, it's also important to remember that I've gone through a couple architects' collections, and for every, you know, beautiful, you know, original house or, you know, freestanding building that's really, really a special piece of work, there's at least a dozen kitchen remodels and, you know,
gotcha.
mudroom designs and back porches and kind of the pot boilers.
that pay the bills. Right.
Yeah, that, you know, that's the reality of being an architect, is that it's not all big fancy buildings. There's the everyday practical side of things, and then hopefully you get opportunities to do a couple really special projects.
Well, as much as I'd love to hear about Marcel Boden's kitchen redesigns, what are some of his more notable architectural designs?
I would say, you know, in the Burlington area, certainly the Trinity College buildings that we talked about briefly, and houses. There's some great houses that Marcel designed in the south end of Burlington, along DeForest Road, DeForest Heights, and the south end of the hill section. And what's interesting in Burlington is that we don't have whole neighborhoods of modernist houses, but they're kind of sprinkled around the city. It's something where you'll be driving through a neighborhood maybe developed in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and suddenly, oh, there's a 1950s house. And so you have to look for them. But it's like once you clue into it, I guarantee you will start seeing them everywhere. Once you pick up on that, the aesthetic, you realize, oh, almost every little town in Vermont, you know, if I just go and search these out, they're there. So that's the fun part for me is finding them.
Oh, I love it. Now, he's still living. Boden is still living. You've had conversations with him. So what's he like?
Very, I'd say humble, very friendly. In some cases, people have this notion of the all-knowing, you know, empirical architect, kind of my way or the highway type person or personality. And, you know, Marcel, and I've also talked with a number of people who live in houses he designed and, you know, that were his clients. And they just can't say enough about how thoughtful, how sensitive he was to their needs and arriving at a solution that wasn't necessarily his personal vision, his statement in architecture, but really something that would fit the needs of the client and what they were looking for and what functions and aesthetic they wanted. You know, that said, he certainly worked in a contemporary and modern style. You know, he's not designing, you know, Tudor revival houses or, you know, Queen Anne look-alike. So definitely working in a modernist mode, but certainly with the needs of the client in the forefront.
And how long, we're going to put a bow on this movement, how long did the mid-century modern movement last in Vermont and elsewhere?
Well, in some ways, it's still going. I mean, the influence of the Bauhaus and those early modernists is so strong, and it's hard to believe that, you know, the Bauhaus was founded in 1919. That was more than 100 years ago.
Wow.
And it sort of puts it in perspective.
Yeah.
But it's still going. But certainly there's also been, you know, with every movement, there's a reaction and then a counter-reaction. So a lot has happened since that initial phase of early modernism and international style. But it's certainly an undercurrent that still pervades within architecture schools and practicing architects.
Devin, let's switch gears and move to Prickly Mountain. Is this an actual place or a state of mind, a design style? What is Prickly?
All of the above.
I thought so.
So one of the really fun things about architectural history and looking at our built environment is realizing that things don't happen by the calendar. You know, we don't have, all right, this architectural movement ended this day, and then we started a new one.
Right.
They overlap.
Gotcha.
They mix. They get muddied. You know, you find a Greek Revival house that has a Queen Anne porch on it, and you know, things get blended. And this is a great segue where we've been talking about a more pure modernist approach of very spare, clean lined buildings, flat roofs, walls of glass, to something like Prickly Mountain in the Mad River Valley, which is known as the design build movement. And it's, you know, really one of, if not the only architectural movements really born in Vermont. And it was the genesis of a couple of Yale architecture school grads, David Sellers, Peter Gluck, and Bill Reinecke, and friends of theirs who moved to the Mad River Valley in the 1960s. And wanted to start building. And they had been trained as architects at Yale and were really dissatisfied with the current state of the profession, in which the architect was the designer and then their designs were executed by builders. And there's a very clear hierarchy of the architect is the kind of the all-knowing, all-powerful creator, and then there's the builder who executes what the architect tells the builder to do. And they wanted to do both. And so they bought land in Prickly Mountain and said, you know, we're going to both design the buildings and build them, and in fact, we're going to design as we build. And so, which, you know, we talked about Marcel Bowden and Don McKnight's architectural archives. You know, those are the sets of architectural drawings that they created, which were then used to build buildings. The design build movement, there's really not an archive of drawings because they didn't do drawings beforehand in most cases. In fact, in some buildings you can go today and you can look at an exposed wooden truss and see the pencil sketch where somebody drew out, all right, this is how we're going to build this truss. They sketched it out on the 2x12 and then built it.
Wow.
So it's really this trying to break down the barriers, not unlike what the Bauhaus wanted to do with integrating architecture and design and craft. The design build movement really wanted to break down the barriers between the architect and the designer and the builder and make them all part of the process.
Looking at these structures now, they're, I don't know, a bit dated maybe. They're interesting in a funky, funky way. How were they viewed when they were first created?
You know, I think initially they were, they got a lot of press. You know, Life magazine cover stories about, you know, these weird, you know, hippie buildings on a mountain in Vermont.
Yeah.
And I think they were maybe viewed with a little little bit of a, you know, what the heck is this curiosity factor.
Mm-hmm.
But these buildings, some of them are now more than 50 years old, and we have to start thinking critically about them and questioning, like, okay, what was the context in which these buildings were created? You know, buildings don't appear out of thin air.
Mm-hmm.
They, you know, somebody has to think of it and do it. And, you know, my role as an architectural historian is then figuring out, okay, why? You know, why did they come to Vermont? Why did these Yale-trained architects, who really, you know, could have taken a job in any firm around the country, why did they want to strike out in rural Vermont and start building these wacky houses out of scavenged plywood and lumber? And then what does that say about Vermont in the 1960s? You know, it gets into the whole back to the land movement,
right,
and people wanting to escape the urban centers and live more with nature. It also ties into the ski industry. You know, it's not a coincidence that they chose the Mad River Valley, where Sugarbush Ski
right,
Mountain is,
right,
is located. So, you know, they saw an opportunity that people might want vacation homes in this area, and maybe we could design and build those. So it's really, once you get past the funky, amusing aspects to the harder questions of, okay, what does this say about our culture in the 1960s, that it gets really interesting.
How has or has the design build look changed, or, you know, anything about it changed from those initial creations?
That's a good question. I think the, you know, one of the attractions, from what David Sellers has told me of Warren and the Mad River Valley, is that initially there really weren't any zoning regulations, so they could kind of do what they wanted. You know, now, of course, there's a little more structure and some guardrails to design in terms of, you know, structural stability and life safety and things like that. But I think the overall approach and thinking hasn't changed. David is still working. He's doing new buildings right now on Prickly Mountain.
Mm.
And, you know, always thinking forward to what's the next project and the next challenge that he can present for himself.
These original Prickly Mountain homes and buildings, how many are there from, like, kind of the initial set? Is there kind of a grouping?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'd say, you know, maybe a dozen or so.
Mm-hmm.
On Prickly Mountain, and they really range from some that are more finely detailed to others that are just kind of whimsically put together and really a rethinking of what a home is, you know, how you move through spaces.
I remember
visiting one house where you don't have a traditional, you know, corridor hallway with rooms coming off each side. You know, it's more you're in one space and you climb a ladder to get to the next room, and then you go through that room and down a few steps into the next room. And, you know, really, it forces you to question, you know, why do most houses look one way and these look this way? And that's the fun part. And they're engaging. You know, I think that's another part of why the Prickly Mountain and design build houses are notable, is that they're a counter reaction to the more strict modernism.
Mm-hmm.
That some people were seeing as, you know, it's a little austere, you know? And then here comes David Sellers and his crew doing these funky, you know, there's color, you know, there's
right,
paper graphics on the walls, and just really asking the question, well, why not have some fun? Why not have a big curved plexiglass window and little porch jutting out from a weird place on the exterior, and just sort of a more of a free free-thinking approach to design.
Hmm. To your knowledge, is there ever a tour available to see these buildings?
There have been tours. I know that in the past, Yestermorrow School has done tours of some of the buildings, which is a lot of the Prickly Mountain folks helped with the founding of Yestermorrow Design Build School. And so there are opportunities to see them. I will say they are, you know, private houses. So
right.
Recommend if folks want to seek them out, just respect respect the property owner's privacy. But there are opportunities. A good example is the Picture Inn, which is an inn in Warren that David Sellers designed, and just a fascinating. Every room is different with a complete design by Sellers, and really a special place to see, kind of see inside his mind what's going on there.
And Devin, we only have about a minute left, but if someone has a day to drive around and see some interesting Vermont architecture, where would you send them?
I would say, you know, for a publicly accessible little driving tour, check out Bennington College. The Bennington College campus has an amazing collection of both mid-century modern and contemporary architecture. And that's another project that campus that will be listed in the National Register shortly. So Bennington College is a great place. Norwich, Vermont has a lot of great houses connected to Dartmouth College and the medical center there. That's another good spot. And then around Burlington, the hill section, the south end of Burlington, has some good examples as well.
Oh, beautiful. Devin Coleman is the state architectural historian. Devin, I want to thank you so much for this interesting lesson this morning.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Take care. That's our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Feel free to suggest topics or guests. You can listen to past episodes at WDEVradio.com. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. Then we've got the Midday News Service. And after that, Greg Hooker with 4 hours of The Getaway. I'm Rick Sengary. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.